This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Wednesday, 28th of July, 2021, and FOMC Day. And with volatility picking up heading into today, potentially a very interesting one. Of course, other areas of volatility this week, especially in Chinese equities, a big focus point. And we have Stein Jakobsen, our Chief Investment Officer, on the call today. Just a brief wrap-up of the market action yesterday. So U.S. Market yesterday, whether this is some degree of the volatility in China feeding through, causing some bit of concern, or whether it's new mask mandates from CDC potentially coming into play here as well, or just simple nervousness and taking some chips off the table ahead of FOMC. Hard to differentiate what's what. But in any case, a pretty weak session in the U.S., especially the mega cap heavy NASDAQ 100. And I have another chart today, so refreshing that one from yesterday. With this session, you're starting to get a bit of confirmation on the divergent momentum setup. Interesting that we had three of the most massive U.S. companies reporting after the close, $57 billion in profits for one quarter. I think there's an issue there with a potential going forward for antitrust. But look at our baskets. We're still seeing this very inferior performance of these baskets, many of which are in these more interesting or what have been more interesting speculative areas. And then pulling out from that as well, the MSCI down 2% on the one day, 2.1%, and 8.6% month to date. Of course, a lot of that is the heavy Chinese weight there, among emerging market stocks and, of course, the allocations. So Stein Jakobsen, we have you on the line. We saw another session overnight where more nervousness in China, further sell-off. We've seen a crackdown and then sort of closing around unchanged or getting back towards there as I snap this chart anyway on slide 3. It's a big drop. And of course, a lot of this is driven by Chinese crackdowns on online companies and especially this recent blast against online education companies. There was an interesting article out from Bloomberg yesterday talking about these pillars of principles that some of these moves are based on. What is your take on what's going on in the Chinese equity market here? And is this mostly foreigners pulling out that is driving a lot of this downside, this sort of a shift in allocation, if you will?
It's certainly the foreigners who are selling, and talking to domestic strategists in China, it's very clear that the narrative in China as well is that this is foreigners pulling out money. And I think it's probably important to remind everybody that if you're long MSCI Asia in any shape or form, you are benchmarked to be long at least 50% Chinese equity. So of course, the kind of performance that you alluded to is really hitting hard on the year-to-date performance, which of course is down for all of the Chinese indices now. And on top of that, of course, you have the fact that as a equity analyst bottom up, you probably have to reduce the risk premium that you get from the Chinese market, considering that there is, I wouldn't call it arbitrarian, but certainly to some extent, random crackdown on different industries, all of which plays to the same theme, which is that, you know, President Xi has outlined his next 5 years. It is with a priority on green transformation. It's a priority on being a provider and producer of chips, AI, and renewable energy overall. So, you know, it's, you know, the money will flow. And I think one interesting characteristic, one interesting note of yesterday was, of course, that the biggest chip maker in China was up limit 20% in a market that was down overall on average 5%. So, absolutely something's going on. And I think at a lot of positioning going into what it's, you know, considered the midterm in the Chinese political calendar, which is the Congress and the positioning for June 22, means that all the bureaucrats, all the local provinces, all of them are trying to reduce the amount of CO2 emission, and they want to be championing these investment themes. And a lot of the bureaucrats that sits in the regulatory framework also wants to make sure that the presidency gets their attention. So, you know, I think some of it is, of course, governed by what happens and what is outlined by the top management of China. But don't forget, in the Chinese system, the underlings operate with a goal to be more visible to the leadership, and hence they tend to do this. But everything is about inequality. The access to education needs to be broad-based. You could argue the US has the same kind of system where the top 10% fights for the best universities. That's only 10% of the population, but in China, it's 100% of the population. And it's one of these very, very important goals to get everyone equal access, and in the process, of course, increase the educational level. In terms of the internet crackdown, it's pretty simple. It's China realizing that the Biden administration is not going to be any more friendly than the Trump administration. And as such, they are now preparing for what in the US is defined as this open competition. In open competition in the minds of the Chinese means that the internet, it cannot be counted on as a source of growth. And more importantly, of course, there is too much individualism on the internet, and ability to navigate both the Great Wall, the internet protection that the Chinese authorities have in place, but also operate and do it. And interesting enough, from the sources I talked to, I think the key event that drove this internet crackdown has been the fact that China realize and have seen evidence how the US election was manipulated. And they feel if the US election can be manipulated, that can be politically unstable in China. And hence we see this reaction. So I know it's a long answer to your question, John, but I think it's at the same time, it's a very complicated yet very simple narrative that we're operating in. It is that the Chinese leadership wants to control the message. They want to control the forward move, both in terms of communication, i.e. the internet, but also in terms of the investment, which area we go to over the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, and it's very interesting you bring that up, because you know, and China has a very direct way of being able to address this, because of its very nature and framework, whereas you see actually the U.S. is really grappling with some of the same issues, but its system has a much harder time figuring out how to approach this and how to deal with this, and everything gets split up along the lines of politics and everything else. And just as I mentioned, overnight, this $57 billion of profit in one quarter for three companies, such an increasing amount of the pie is going to these super elite companies, monopolies. It is one of the challenges for our time and for our system, at least in the U.S., for figuring out if there's a way to address that, to address this tendency for everything to snowball to the large incumbents.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but maybe one key difference between China and the U.S., and I agree, it's kind of funny from a macro point of view, the process going on in China, it's not that different from the process going on in the U.S. I think there is a leniency towards more intervention rather than less. There is a protection of the meshes. But one key difference is that the Chinese never bought into the concept that the technology platform, the digital platform, was productive. Whereas in the US, the key single driver every time somebody is hyping the US, it is the fact that all of the biggest technology companies in the world is funded and operated out of the US. So it's interesting. It's not just a political difference. It's actually also a, you know, you call it economist difference, that they don't seem to believe that the internet can create the value over a longer period, whereas the US says, you know, the spillover effect, the net effect, the wealth effect that come from internet is different. And to some extent, I haven't figured out how to use that going forward, but I think it is something we need to put into the equation when we look at the different path that US and China is taking right now.
Yeah, very key points there. All right, we need to switch over to, a couple of things, the FOMC chiefly, but I thought I would pull in a chart that I flash once in a while, and that is our risk indicator. You can see it on slide 4. It's a number of measures of risk that are put into an index and basically measured in terms of standard deviation around a moving average. So it's kind of interesting sometimes when things get a bit divergent. So you're seeing new highs, for example, in equities, and significantly new less high levels in our risk indicator. That was the case in late February ahead of the huge pandemic blow up. I'm not trying to predict a new blow up on anything the scale of this five standard deviation move we saw, as you can see on slide four. I had to actually expand that y-axis to incorporate new levels of standard deviation. But I think it is remarkable that we are at these levels relative to the moving average when we've just seen some new highs in the U.S. We've talked a lot about how the rally has been too concentrated in some of these big, handful of hyper cap, almost, if you will, names. I just want to pull that out. And we are seeing some deterioration in credit to a degree, very modest stuff on the corporate credit side, but it is directionally fairly persistent, and even more so in emerging markets, where we're seeing the emerging market spread measure that we look at least into this model is at multi-month wides. And now let's go to other measures. And I think I want to set this up for asking you a question, Steen. That is, if you look at slide five, we see how we've basically entirely unwound, say for a basis point or two, the entire reaction to the June FOMC meeting in terms of that aha moment that the Fed has sort of edged over into a tightening regime, and was even in its forecasts, basically the median forecast, pulling forward the date of that first rate hike into late 2023. And part of maybe the driver for maybe some concern that the Fed may need to talk taper, on the other hand, in other words, a more hawkish policy in this crazy buildup again in the reverse repo facility, which is edging back towards $1 trillion. That's the other chart there you see on the bottom right on slide five. I suppose the rate hike anticipation is partly around this whole Delta variant outbreak and the concerns around that. Maybe the growth has peaked, et cetera. But where do you see the balance of risks going into this Fed meeting? To me, there's only really one big surprise direction, that is to the hawkish side. But then it's about figuring out what are the odds that we tilt more hawkish, I guess, at this meeting today. What are your thoughts, Steen?
So from a top-down perspective, everything you describe really is that you have too much money chasing too few assets in the US. And that's why we have this overflow of capital sitting inside the banking system, why the reverse repo is being used as much as it is. So if you have too much money chasing too few assets, there's really only one thing that the doctor can prescribe, and that is to do taper, which in time and in size is faster and bigger than the market expects. And that is exactly what goes on. So if you have too much money chasing too few assets, you need to retire some of that inflow that comes into the money market and the banking system and make the timeline. The reason why we tilt, at least I personally tilt quite hawkish on the meeting today. And when I say hawkish, it's not that they're going to announce they do taper today, but I think there is a continuation from the June meeting in that they see and they have moved the needle on inflation. So early on, we were talking about transitory first being defined as 3 to 6 months, then transitory was defined as 6 to 12 months. And now Yellen and to some extent Powell are both talking about temporary inflation. In other words, there is a marginal change in the perception by the Federal Reserve and certainly by the White House on what is the inflation and how long will it last. And that comes at a time where we, and I think everyone acknowledged the fact that the U.S. Treasury and the White House and of course the Fed has been moving on a full employment mandate before anything else. They simply moved and re-edited all of the bylaws that dictate what Fed needs to do to say that we need full employment. Full employment being 3% or below 3%. The interesting thing is that we're not at 3%. Actually, we have 8 million jobs being unfilled in 6 million jobs being unfilled in the last jobs report. But we have the first derivative of what equates to a 3% employment. Sounds complicated. What I'm really saying is that no, we are not at 3%, but yes, we do have the impact on wages, which is going significantly higher. And we see every single day pieces of evidence that companies need to pay at very, very high amount to attract employees to come work. In the case, not US, but this morning, I see Tesco, the supermarket chain, had to pay £1,000 to get drivers to actually take the lorries around the UK. So in other words, we have not achieved the economic goal, but we have achieved what is the first derivative, which is the increase in wages. Of course, anyone, and especially someone like Yellen, who is a labor economist, will acknowledge this as being at risk for inflation from moving from being transitory, temporary, to being more permanent in nature. As such, I think there is an agreement, and from what I hear through the great ones, there have been a number of meetings between the Fed leadership and the White House. And I think the White House publicly by Biden has been out saying that the Fed needs to do what it needs to do, which is kind of unusual in the political rhetoric, because of course, any president in the US just wants the Fed to lower rates as much as possible to get the maximum growth. But I think there's a game book here that is being played on both sides. One is that, you know, coming back from recess, 1st of September, Congress needs to start the midterm election. It would not be optically very, very bad if there was a little bit of noise on the wire coming back in September, October. You need to talk about debt ceiling extension. You need to talk about the new budgets. You need to talk about infrastructure. So I think it fits the White House. Why does it fit the Fed? It fits the Fed because simply it creates an opportunity, a insurance premium against needing to do something later. So if you think of the concept of a Fed right now, I think the consensus right now is that taper will start in November, December. It will run for a year. So the opportunity cost here is very, very small, because if they start tapering a little bit of a few notches today on it, and then the Jackson Hole, they start to say that they are ready to talk about it instead of not having a talk about it. Now they have a talk about it. And then in September, they execute. If they execute in September, they'll be finished most likely by September next year. The price of that is 1 or 2 months of additional QE, $200 billion in a balance sheet that at the time will be about $10 trillion. So Mickey Mouse money in central bank speak. But the opportunity cost is very, very small. And I think preloading, front loading the conversation here, and at a time where we have the euro dollar complex showing you no expectation of higher rates, basically, if you look at the euro dollar as an indicator for future rates, it's indicating that we are below 2% long term rates in the US, short term rates forever, and forever being the horizon by which we look into the future, which is, you know, 5 to 6 years. So all added up, I think it's an interesting, if it happens, it's an interesting timing. We are all-time high in stock market. We are all-time high in housing markets. We have a very, very high relative commodity price. We have a lot of inflation pressure. The right thing to do is to withdraw. And remember, they are not contracting. They are just reducing a pace at which they are doing QE. With a lead time by 1 year. So what sits up against that, and the pushback I got from that internal note I wrote on that, is that, you know, Powell has promised that he would be very expressive and very clear about when they're going to change. What I'm saying is, I think tonight is potentially the night where he says we are ready to talk about this, indicating that the September meeting is in play, and then he will make, you know, slight adjustments for Jackson Hole.
So I assume in terms of market reaction, that would point towards volatility risk, risk off. But it doesn't feel to me like this market, you know, there's chatter about Delta variant this, Delta variant that, is prepared for this message tonight, if that is the message we get.
No, I agree. I think the people are long. I mean, the leverage is high, the margin accounts on the retail side is high, and certainly the professional environment in fixed income doesn't buy into this concept that I just outlined at all. They think that the Fed is very, very transparent, and then they will be rather be slow to the party than early to the party. And that's where the difference lies right now. So we are talking 90, if not 95% anti-consensus here.
All right, let's round out the FX action. So it'd be interesting to see, of course, if the dollar would pick up around that, or and to what degree, you know, spectacular outperformance of US stocks has been a driver of dollar. But You see the overview on slide six. Do note that the Chinese renminbi, certainly with this latest episode, has stopped trading as a sort of low beta U.S. dollar for obvious reasons with its underperformance in equities. Quite a momentum shift there, and interesting to note that correlation has kind of broken down. Elsewhere, interesting focus on commodities. We're still seeing the weak Aussie and Aki readings, that contrasting with a sideways Canadian dollar and sterling really picking up here. There was I put in a euro sterling chart here. There was a news item that the EU is stepping away from confronting the UK here and now about the Northern Ireland custom border issue. They're going to chat about that apparently for the rest of the summer. And it's interesting, of course, to note that sterling rising towards the highs there, or euro sterling dropping towards the lows of the cycle since the actual Brexit happened there at the beginning of the year. And then on the earnings front, Facebook is the biggest name up reporting today after the close. You can see the chart on slide seven. And with yesterday's earnings reports, Google very much reporting a massive surge in online ad spending, especially from retail. And you would expect that trend to continue through with Facebook. Be interesting to see their forward guidance and, of course, general concerns about antitrust, et cetera. Other names you can see reporting for the tomorrow and the rest of the week are on slide seven. And then on the calendar, again, the only real focus is this FOMC meeting tonight, and especially the Powell conference, because we're not sure how much can be said in the statement, but it will be interesting to see if there's any hints in the statement, which tends to be extremely, very marginal changes to the statement over the last few cycles. So we're watching both of those very closely. I think it's an awkward message for Powell to deliver if he is going to have to shift more towards the direction of indicating that the September FOMC meeting is alive, as Steen indicated. Also, the latest weekly crude oil and product inventory numbers out of the U.S., a Canadian CPI print, and other bits and pieces through the end of the week, including a Q2 GDP estimate, the first one from the U.S. out tomorrow. So, stay careful out there. This could be potentially a very key meeting, could spark some considerable volatility. So be ready for that. And we'll be back tomorrow, of course, with the Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.